from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those of us of a certain age, there's a lot of anxiety about whether people will adapt to renewable energy. But for younger generations, millennials, for example, it's not really a question. This transition is inevitable. This comes up in James Redford's new documentary about clean energy. He asks a woman if there was a moment in the last decade that stands out, and she said it was when she was talking to young people about energy. They're not even questioning that this transition is happening, she says. It just is. It's just happening. Which gave Redford a title for his film, Happening. We're going to be screening the film next week as part of our documentary series. James Redford is joining us today to talk about the film, which is his quest to learn about the future of clean energy. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the opening scene from his latest documentary, James Redford is in New York City, as two momentous scenes are competing for people's attention. On one hand, there was a march for action on climate change. A few blocks away, though, there were dozens and dozens of people standing in line for the new iPhone. And it's a good way of illustrating a question Redford gets at in the film. This is an exciting era for technology, but how are we going to be using it? His film is about the clean energy revolution, solar and wind and thermal, and how the American economy is poised to make this transition away from fossil fuels. The film is Redford's own personal journey to figure out if we can make enough renewable energy to supply the world and replace fossil fuels, and if we can, how do we do it? Will we do it? The film is called Happening. It's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film next week. Today in the program, James Redford is joining us to talk about it. He's the founder and director of the Redford Center. It's a media nonprofit that addresses challenging environmental issues by looking for hopeful solutions. He wrote and directed the film. It's called Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. And he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. James Redford, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's an honor to be here.
Let me pose a couple of questions for those of you listening. What is preventing you from using more clean energy sources? Why haven't you, for example, put solar panels on your house? Is it the cost? Are there some political dimensions here? You can call us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. James Redford, let me start with, what is it that got you started with this particular film? I know you think a lot about climate change. You think a lot about renewable energy. But when did you start to think that you had something to say, you know, in terms of a film?
Well, you know, going back to 2012, or really even 2007, when I saw an Inconvenient Truth, and then the question there was, wow, you know, the tiny bit of your brain that says, boy, let's hope he's wrong. It's not looking like he's wrong, but let's hope it. And then in 2012, I saw Chasing Ice, and I was like, well, no, he's right, and here we are. Here's the moment of truth. Seeing is believing.
Yeah.
And yet I realized that there's this odd thing where it seems like the more clear the message of climate change becomes, the more people seem to be disengaging. Hmm. So there's an aspect of denial, and what is that? Well, I think, you know, I felt like you go into denial when you feel like there's no hope. It's a realist, it's a sensible reaction when it's hopeless. So the question is it hopeless or not? And I knew that renewable energy was one of the few big solutions to climate change. And I was really curious about whether or not we could actually make this transition, and what is this whole clean energy thing all about anyway? I mean, the average person, it just sounds kind of boring. Let's admit it. Right. I mean, is there anything more boring than staring at a solar panel?
Yeah, yeah.
So my curiosity got up, and I just decided, you know, perhaps because I'm not an expert and it is so complicated, maybe I'll just track my own process of educating myself, and that would be the story.
It seems like that is the theme for the film, your personal journey, but also the fact that you're not really an expert. You're as kind of dopey about these particular details as the rest of us. I have to say, that's the thing that was really appealing about the film, is a lot of us don't really understand how it works, and the fact that you didn't was kind of helpful in some way.
Well, you know, I certainly, I got like a D in science in my sophomore year in high school, you know. So, you know, it's I'm fascinated by it, but I, you know, it takes me really a long time. I need to simplify everything for myself. And I thought, well, if I'm simplifying this for myself, I bet a lot of people would appreciate that. Hopefully they will.
Yeah. You said that at the beginning of this process, you were feeling pretty cynical. Say a little bit more about that, how you were feeling. And maybe it was just that reference to that hopelessness. But in some ways, you were – that kind of comes out in the film, this kind of – I don't know if cynicism as much as skepticism, though, about whether it could work.
Well, yeah. I feel like, I was aware – first of all, 4 years ago, I was already questioning whether things could have really happened significantly at the federal level. And that was before we elected a president who's doing everything he can to slow down clean energy advancements. So, you know, and therefore it sort of informed my cynicism about the political process. And as I started to learn about clean energy, I was greatly inspired by how much was being taken up economically, and that the things that were advancing in the marketplace among people that were politically colorblind. And you had all the money coming in, the places it was happening. It was all happening based on economics, and that was superseding political division. So I was really interested in that and thinking to myself, well, maybe we can do this without the political process. But it didn't really end up being that way.
Yeah.
And then in an odd way, I was rather humbled by the reminder of how important the political process is, because as you see in the film, there's hope there as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a moment, I want to play this moment. This happens later in the film, and we'll get back to it a little bit later in the conversation. But it's a moment when a decision, basically a political decision, is made in Nevada. And it leaves thousands of people without jobs in the solar industry, one particular company that you visit, and it's kind of heartbreaking. And it's a moment in the film when you're really – it's one of those moments when you're really feeling frustrated. Let me play this moment. We can talk about it.
I'm telling you, when you see up close and personal the human toll that bureaucratic and corporate chess playing takes on individuals, it makes me really mad. This is yet another example of the interest of the mighty against the interest of the many. And that's upsetting to me. Because you know what? Those kinds of situations don't change without amendments, without congressional action, without Supreme Court victories. You can't innovate your way out of the bullshit that I witnessed today. It's going to take a fight. It's just too bad.
What do you think now? That story turned a bit, and we'll get back to that, as I said. But the fact that you are feeling you can't innovate your way out of this part, you know, the corporate part, the corporate interest part, the political part, are you still feeling that way?
Well, I think if there's, you know, if you ask me what do I hope this film accomplishes, I hope it sets the stage for more political action, particularly at the city and state level, where it's still malleable, where people still respond. I mean, you know, you can change things pretty quickly at that level. I'm not very hopeful at the federal level. How could you be right now?
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think that's a reason to walk away from all of this. I think you just shift your target. And that's what we need to do right now. And it's doable at the city and state level. That's how I feel after witnessing the good and the bad in Nevada.
Mm. Let me go back to that that march that I mentioned earlier in the introduction. You had these two competing gatherings. You know, the one was the iPhone store, and the other was this march in New York City for climate change action for climate change. And you say in the film that you'd been skeptical of marches. But then what you saw seemed to be really inspiring in some ways, and it seemed like kind of an impetus for the journey in some ways.
Yeah, it was, you know, if I was allowed to describe that that event that day, I would have said, I guess you could call it a march, but if anything, it was more like Mardi Gras. I mean, it was a total celebration, and I was really struck by that. I just didn't understand. I was anticipating the hardened environmental core showing up with a kind of, you know, righteous and understandingly so, righteous anger. But it was really not that at all. And so that really left me puzzled almost by this sort of sense of joie de vivre and optimism that day, you know.
Yeah, 400,000 people showed up. And you say that and then the film is where you kind of lay out the questions you wanted to get at on the quest that you go through. First of all, can we make enough of this renewable energy to supply the world and replace fossil fuels? Like that's the question. But then it's how are we going to do that? And then it's will we do that? Now let's go through some of those as we go. It seems like those is that the way to focus the film to say that's what it's about.
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, in some cases, it's, you know, it's about technology. And then in other cases, it's about process, you know, the way you use it. But then in the other case, there's also the will and the motivation, whether it's economic or political or otherwise, yeah. Environmental. And that's the squirrely one.
Right. There's a family connection here that we should point out before we jump in that you lay out in the film. Your grandfather, Charlie Redford, he was an oil man. I guess, is that the right way to put it?
Yes, absolutely. Clawed out of the Great Depression. Thanks, Standard Oil.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the thing I feel is that, you know, if my grandfather was reincarnated and starting out now and looking at what he was going to do, what was exciting— my guess is he would be in the renewable energy business because back in those days, this was exciting stuff. I mean, we didn't understand the complexities of carbon CO2 and carbon burning and all the things that we now know. It was just a way to really create a better product, just like clean energy is now. It's just a better product.
Yeah. That's a theme in the film, it seems like. I mean, you keep going back to that one. I think it's important to, I guess, keep pointing that out.
Yes. I don't know if you've, you know, just every time something crops up, a new piece of technology in renewable, if you see it and read about it, a part of your brain goes, wow, that's just cool. I mean, have you seen any images of the new Tesla semi-truck?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the coolest truck that's ever been made.
It's true.
So, you know, there's that too.
Yeah. Your father, for those who don't know, is the actor Robert Redford. He went in a different direction for his life than his father, of course, as you say in the film, becomes an artist, of course, and a performer. I wondered, was that in some way a reaction to his father's business? Did that have anything to do with the direction that he went in his life?
So my grandpa Charlie was probably one of the few committed Democrats that worked at the Richmond Refinery. And he was, you know, and he was a good man and a well-loved by his colleagues. But I know that he was proud of what my dad did and that he was not content just to have this extraordinarily successful career in the movies. He was motivated. And, you know, my dad grew up in the Depression with a household of Democrats. So, you know, he had this sort of and same with my mother, by the way, there in Utah. Yeah. I think, you know, her mother and father both ran for mayor of Provo. I think, you know, they both got about 12 votes each as Democrats in Provo.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did it.
Yep.
So it's not unusual. You know, both my parents were very engaged and active. And I think, you know, my grandparents would have been very proud.
As you point out in the film, your parents were really engaged in this issue in the really early days of solar Maybe say something about the short film they made, because you mentioned it in the film. This was, I think, 1980, which was, you know, for solar terms, that was way early. But say something about that, because this was really interesting.
Yes. So if you watch the film, one of the striking things is there's absolutely no notion of climate change or greenhouse gases. The idea in the film at the time, we'd come off the oil embargo of the mid-70s when OPEC, you know, shut down production and created huge lines at the gas stations in America. And it was our first wave of smaller cars. It was the first time we realized there are problems with gasoline and oil. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that we were vulnerable to international instabilities was a big issue in those days. It was also, as it remains today, the big concern in those days was how dirty oil and gas is, how bad it is for our health, how much pollution it generates, how it hurts our children's health. There were so many reasons to try and find another way to move around and make the energy in our lives work, just based on the health aspects of the problems with fossil fuels. And those are all still there today.
Yeah.
They've just gotten somehow lost in the midst, I think, because we're thinking so much about climate change. But even if you don't believe in climate change, you have every reason to want to get rid of fossil fuels on health issues alone.
Yeah.
So they were really all about that. And if you ask my dad about it, he would say, well, he's sort of wistful about it because, you know, solar in those days was so expensive and had a long way to go. And, you know, when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, one of the first things he did is he had the solar panels that Jimmy Carter had put on the White House ripped off.
Right.
And so began a new era in which it was all about oil and gas in the 80s.
Was there a sense of urgency about this? I know your father, of course, and your mother too, we should always say that, were really engaged in these environmental questions. So did that sense of urgency just sort of seep into your bloodstream? I mean, that was just, was it inevitable that you were going to be asking these kinds of questions and thinking about these kinds of things?
Well, I have a feeling that I was in an unusual position in which I was exposed to the realities of greenhouse gases really, really early on. In 1988, my dad was invited to come over to the Soviet Union because he was involved. He had an organization at the time called the Institute for Resource Management. And the function in those days of that organization was to try and find common ground between environmentalists and people in the, you know, oil industry and other extractive industries. And in doing so, he ended up being invited to go over to the Soviet Union and attend a meeting between U.S. and Soviet climatologists who were talking about something called the greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
And this is in 1988. I went with him, and I was in graduate school at the time. And I was sort of mildly curious, but as the day went on, I was wearing these translator headphones. It was like, whoa, like here we are. It's still in the midst of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and yet these scientists are concerned enough to come together and talk about this. So it's always been in the back of my head, and I kept waiting for someone just to say, no, they were wrong.
Yeah.
It just never happened.
Right. So let's talk about how you conceive of the film as this quest. So you go and talk with a friend. He's a friend who helps get capital to these renewable energy projects. And he talks with you about how, and I thought this was interesting, the last technological revolution, the last 30 to 40 years, that was about the microchip. But he says this next revolution, it's energy. This is the next thing. Say something about that, because this is a kind of the groundwork for the film.
Well, I think what you see there is the mind of a classic entrepreneur going for opportunity.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, not a mention of saving the planet. You know, it's the next hot thing. And boy, has that been proven out. I mean, even since the beginning, since I started looking into this 4 years ago and started in on making this project, the economic juggernaut is incredible. I mean, there was, when I started, I think there was about half as many jobs in solar as there were in oil and gas. Now there are 2.5 times as many jobs as there are in oil and gas. You know, the changes are rapid. It took 40 years to get to the first million solar systems for American homes.
Yeah.
It's going to take 2 years to get to the next million.
Right.
I mean, and so if you're an entrepreneur, you can't help but look at this and go, whoa, I want in.
Yeah. It's interesting. This friend of yours, his name is Matthew Norden, and you're having this conversation, and he discusses with you what he calls energy paralysis. Well, talk a little bit about that, because I think this is important. I think this gets at something we were mentioning earlier.
Well, you know, I've always been my best learning takes place in real time and space. Yeah. I need to learn things in an intuitive fashion. So what he's talking about is that the information and the two things. One, the complexity of the technology, and two, the profundity of climate change. You put those two things together and you just want to go back to watching kiddie videos on YouTube.
Right.
So, you know, how do you avoid falling back on the kiddie videos? You know, for me, it was, I got to make this thing real somehow. And, you know, he suggested that if I really want to make it real, track my electricity. Where is it made? How does it get to your house?
But literally track it, because he's a trail runner and it's something he says he does.
Yeah, and it really struck me. Of course, I was too lazy to do it that way. I decided to go from my house to the source instead.
Yeah. So. Let me play another moment from the film. This is, you're on the phone, actually. You're in your car doing this. You're tracking your energy footprint, and you're on the phone with your dad, basically explaining to him what you're doing, and he's amused.
Well, you know, I mean, I got to say, I swear to God, he just called me out of the blue at that moment. That was not staged or anything. He just simply called me, and then, you know, so there you go.
Yeah, it's great.
What do you mean you're looking for electricity? What is that about?
I just thought I would try and figure out where the hell my electricity comes from.
Can't you check your meter and find out that way?
Well, but it doesn't say where the origin is. It doesn't tell you, like, literally where it's from.
Wow, what an interesting little journey we're on. And incredibly boring.
Yeah.
Pretty sleepy little town. I mean, it seems like it's holding its own economically. Probably because there is a power plant here, right? There it is. There's my nearest power plant. Pittsburgh Generating Station. I found it.
Just a tangle of utility lines going over everything. It is suitably depressing. And as you can see, it makes electricity, and everyone says, oh, all right, well, that's good enough. But when you turn this way and look across the bay, whoa! Tons of windmills. So, you tell me, how do you want to make your power? I mean, intuitively speaking, is this what you want your power plant to look like, or that?
I guess the image that we're seeing is clear enough in the way you described it, but it's a pretty interesting contrast. James Redford, mention that if you would.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, the journey took me to the sort of the Sacramento River where it meets the Bay Area, and about an hour and a half from Marin County, where I live near San Francisco. And you know, the power plant there is it's got barbed wire coiled around it. It's heavily guarded. It looks dirty. It's gas, you know, it's not as bad as a coal-fired plant, but nonetheless, when you look at it, you just sort of say, wow, that's ugly and necessary. And then, you know, and I had no idea. I mean, I was literally just going out there to figure that out. And then when I looked across the bay, I saw this stunning sight of hundreds and hundreds of windmills just spinning away. And I just thought it was the most extraordinarily ironic thing, you know, so... Then I went over there and did a little trespassing.
Yeah, yeah. James Redford is with us. He wrote and directed the documentary film Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. Next Thursday night, that's December 14th, we're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our documentary film. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. James Redford will be joining us for a Q&A after the film. We have details about it on our website. Go to radiowest.org to find them. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with James Redford about his latest documentary film. It's his quest to learn more about renewable energy and find out if we can make enough of it to supply the world and replace fossil fuels. And then if we can, will we? The film is called Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. We're going to be showing it next week. It's part of our documentary film series. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. James Redford is joining us today from a studio in New York City. Well, let's talk about some of these stops along the way in on this quest. You have to say something about this, about Nipton, California, the world's largest commercial solar thermal facility, because it looks – I mean, you describe it kind of in Lord of the Rings terms. Just describe this facility. It's extraordinary.
Well, we're in the middle of the Mojave Desert in a vast basin and range valley. And there's this in sort of on the flanks of this valley are hundreds of thousands of mirrors all arranged concentrically around these towers. Yeah. And they are reflecting sunlight back to a singular point of these towers that creates just super, super hot temperatures that create steam that turns turbines. And there's three of them. And this is called concentrated solar. And this one just went straight to steam. So it was, you know, and here's an example of, you know, that was 2.5 years ago. And in the interim period, now those towers are being deployed with a salt formula, molten salt, so that when the sun heats it up, it continues to stay super hot all through the night, boiling water and creating steam, which allows you to get past some of the problems with solar, which is that when the sun goes down, so does the solar energy.
Yeah.
So, you know, this idea of continuing to take advantage of solar by creating ways to extend its power beyond daylight hours, that's a big opportunity. And so that's what that plant was meant to do. And now there are plants with salt towers all around the world. So that was just the beginning.
Yeah. The pace of technology is pretty amazing. I mean, it must be hard making a documentary keeping up with the technology. It's changing all the time.
Totally frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, when you finish a film, you want to feel like you've got it. This is all there is to say, and I have the luxury of saying it. But the minute you lock picture, you're already old news.
Yeah.
With renewable energy. I mean, things are changing so fast. You know, when in the film, a fellow from the California Independent Systems Operator, which is the grid system, is all excited because, you know, they had a day in which they were at 40% renewable. Well, last March in California, if you include hydropower, there was a day in which the grid was 80% renewable.
Wow.
80%. So it's more than doubled what they were excited about just 2.5 years ago. You know, and that's all good news. But man, as a filmmaker,
yeah,
it's frustrating.
Yeah. I was taken aback by the part of your quest that looks at the military and renewable energy. I didn't expect – I don't know why. Maybe this shows some sort of bias. But I didn't expect how progressive the military is in that regard.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, but if you look back over time, if you think about some of our most advanced technologies that have come to have consumer applications, so many things start with the military,
and then
progressed into usable technology for the public. This is just a continuation of that. There are also two other key things. One is it's a military advantage, and you know, the Secretary of the Navy at that point explains why it is, and so. There's that. But there's also, you know, the fact is that one of the Navy's largest bases in Maryland is currently experiencing extreme flooding events. And people that live in that community that work for the Navy are often blocked off from getting to their homes or to work because of rising tides. Now, you know, you can either believe in climate change or not. But I think if you can't get to work on a semi-regular basis because suddenly the water's rising, and that's something featured in a film called Tidewater. So the Navy is in a unique position, but the entire armed forces, it's a military advantage to be able to not rely on old technologies. I mean, I think, you know, there was for every 50 convoys of oil shipped, you know, driven across Afghanistan during the early days of that conflict, they were losing one soldier for every 50 convoys. That's a high price to pay.
You know, what was really kind of fascinating is the moment when the as you say, the former Secretary of the Navy at the time when you were talking to him, he was the secretary, was talking about how in some cases just the noise from a generator is a security concern. And being able to take that out of the picture is a huge advantage for safety.
Yeah, that really blew my mind when he said that. You know, there are these aha moments along the way. I think that was definitely one of them. And it's just one of yet another example in this film of when you say it's just a better product, just another example of that.
You ask, the critical question of the former Secretary of the Navy, will the political process change all of this? And I guess at this point, now we're a year into the Trump administration, what can you say, or what do you know, I guess, about all of these sort of progressive innovations now for renewable technology? Do you see those changing in any way in the Department of Defense under Donald Trump?
Well, I've checked in nervously a few times last year to see if there was some big turnaround happening at the Department of Defense. And that's not the case. They're continuing to deploy renewable and clean technologies. It's a juggernaut. It's such a massive – I mean, you know, the military, you know, once they set sail, you know, to turn that around and everything they put into this better technology would take more than a shift in political climate. Now, that isn't to say that you know, that the current head of the EPA or even the White House wouldn't enjoy demanding a switch there, but it hasn't happened thus far. In fact, they've continued to ramp up more and more clean energy thus far. So, who knows what will happen? But you know, it's all systems go at this point.
So, if you were to ask me to guess where the second city that went green is going to be, I would not have gotten anywhere near Texas in my mind. Like, I would have thought of Oregon probably, or some place.
Boulder, Colorado.
Boulder, Colorado. Totally.
Santa Cruz, California.
Exactly. Yeah, go down the list. Totally. Exactly.
Yeah.
But Texas, but Georgetown, Texas. Yeah. All right. Tell us about this place, because this was really interesting.
Well, it's another one of these economic arguments.
Yeah,
really. I mean, you know, in the end, if you're a mayor and your job is to do the best for your constituents, and that includes getting the cheapest power you can, you're going to do that. And the mayor in Georgetown, Texas, just looked at the situation agnostically and realized, and this is the case in Texas because they have a lot of wind power, and they also have a very flexible grid system in which you can get wind power pushed around the state pretty easily. And he looked at that, and as a result of all that, he realized, wow, I can get cheaper wind power than I can traditionally gas-fired electricity or coal-fired electricity. Yeah. So, and they're going to lock in my rates for 20 years. I like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you got to remember that this, or at least know that this mayor, his background was as an accountant.
Yep.
So he's a numbers guy, and it was a numbers play. And to me, that was very, very inspiring and encouraging, because if you can just, you know, look at, if the numbers work, then so many things happen.
Yeah.
And so there he was in the middle of oil country going 100% wind power.
He's a great guy. His name's Dale Ross. Let me play a moment so people can get a sense of what the mayor of Georgetown, Texas is like.
Do people see solar and wind as, oh no, it's going to ruin our way of life and our legacy and our history? Or do they just say, hey man, more energy?
When you do something new and different, if it involves change, I think some people get concerned. They just want to make sure that it works and it doesn't impact them negatively. And in the job markets, I mean, we're still doing tons of oil and gas in Texas.
Right.
We can just use it for other sources other than make electricity. Us good Republicans don't like to raise taxes. And so we're doing all kinds of wonderful things, and the tax rate's staying the same. And so I'm spending money like a Democrat, okay? But it's okay because you have to invest in these things in Georgetown. We do have a banker on here. He's a good friend of mine, and sometimes I just cuss at him. And I'm going, look, what the f*** do you want your legacy to be 100 years from now? Do you cut the tax rate by a penny? You want that on your tombstone? Really? I didn't run on small ideas, and I didn't run to go cut ribbons. I ran to make a change in my community in a meaningful way. And what we need to do now is we need to spend money. If we don't spend money right now in this economy, what, we're going to spend money when we go back in a recession? No. We got to spend the money now.
Is he an outlier, or you think more and more people, more and more local officials who are engaged like him are thinking in this way?
Well, you know, I think right now you could think of him as somewhat of an outlier, although there are other mayors around the country that are Republican that are turning, at least in the case of you know, cheaper clean energy, they're going that route. The mayor of Carmel, Indiana, Jim Brainerd, is one of Mike Pence's good friends, and he's doing the same thing in Carmel, Indiana, because he just sees this – he's just acknowledging the future. You know, he just sees the inevitability. He sees the prices dropping. He sees this coming, and he's just saying, I've got to put everything else aside and deal with the reality here. I think you're going to see more and more of this.
James Redford is with us. He wrote and directed the documentary film Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. Next Thursday night, it's December 14th, we're going to be screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Of course, this is our part of our Through the Lens documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. James Redford will join us for a Q&A after the film. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
It was a summer evening, I think it was in July, and Miles was working the phones. He got a call, a woman who said that her husband was drunk and had two loaded weapons in their apartment, and he was threatened.
A 911 dispatcher gets a call and tries to save a man's life. What happened after that on the next episode of More to Say. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with James Redford. He wrote and directed the documentary film called Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. We're going to be screening it next week, next Thursday night. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. James is joining us today from a studio in New York City. So there's a moment in the film I wanted to ask you about. There's an Emily Kirsch. She's an environmental activist, and she's a renewable energy. She's really engaged in all of this, solar energy in particular. And she says this thing that I thought was interesting. She said, solar used to be about hardware and panels, and now it's psychological. What does she mean by that?
Well, I think she's reacting to the fact that the technology is there, and now it's about the storytelling around it. It's making people aware of what's possible. And, you know, telling a story that makes it easier to comprehend. And in some ways, she was echoing my journey. I mean, this whole business, you know, in the Redford Center, which produces films, you know, our mission as a nonprofit, since this film was made in a nonprofit model, is to deal with solutions and look at vexing problems and try and point towards solutions. It's really hard to do. You know, it's simplifying the story and making it accessible to people You know, there's a reason that in the for-profit environment, you know, people are paying a lot of money to marketers and PR firms to figure out how to do that. And that's the stage that she sees Solar at right now in terms of educating the public and making them aware that, for instance, you don't have to actually buy the panels if you want to. If you just want to have solar, you can go with a leasing program, and you know, or you should work on developing community solar, which is starting to crop up, particularly in California, but all around the country now, where communities can come together and buy, you know, sort of do a mass purchase from their community and have that clean energy brought onto the grid. There's a lot of things that are possible now that, you know, we have to start communicating that.
Yeah. It's interesting, the company Apple, its use of renewable energy, it's the data center, all of the energy used for the massive data center, it's renewable. They've purchased their own solar farm in North Carolina. Their companies are cooled by evaporative cooling. I mean, this – talk a little bit about that. I mean, talk about a leading-edge company, and they're obviously not doing this just for the benefits of the environment, although I'm sure that's part of it. That has to make sense economically for them too.
Well, I think when you're a technology company, particularly a consumer-based technology company, you wake up every day in fear of missing the curve, missing the wave, right? You have to stay ahead of things. You just have to be the one delivering the next thing. And so, you know, whether it's a phone or a computer or, you know, whatever, that's your culture. And so renewable energy and clean energy is just an example of what you need to stay on top of if you want to stay ahead of things, because this thing could break in so many directions in terms of how it's going to change the way we power our lives, how we use technology, how we move around. I mean, right now, you know, we're looking at self-driving electric cars in the next 10 years that are you know, rapidly advancing. It's hard for me to imagine, but you know, it's probably hard for us to imagine a lot of things 10 years ago, including the fact that there'd be by now, you know, a million electric vehicles on our roads. There were 2,000 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So they have to stay ahead of the game, and it's an extension of that.
Well, and I think also, as you said, it's hard for us, people of a certain generation to kind of imagine this stuff, but a younger generation is thinking about it in kind of intuitive ways, and this comes up in your conversation with Lisa Jackson of Apple. Let me play this moment because I referred to it at the top of the show. Here's another moment from James Redford's film.
Is there a moment in the last decade in terms of energy and renewables and efficiency? Does anything stand out?
Probably 5 or 6 years ago, I used to say, I know it's going to change because I know when I talk to young people, they're not even questioning that this is happening. They just understand it. I feel like it's just happening.
I guess that's where you got the title of the film, this idea that it's just happening. And this idea that for young people, they're not having the same questions that we older folks are. It's just, it seems just completely inevitable, I guess, for them. That must seem hopeful to you.
It is. I think, you know, and you see some trends. You see that they're not buying cars the way we did.
Yeah.
And they're just not interested. They have other ways of moving around. It seems like a pain. And it's you know, again, it's a shift. But I also see with the younger people an interesting thing, because not only do they understand clean energy and assume it's coming, but there's more of an awareness beyond that to, well, how do we make this something that works socially as well as environmentally? You know, how do we make sure that it's not just an elite tight green circle of liberal progressives getting clean energy? How do we get it to everybody else? And the social justice aspect of this is really far more on the minds of the millennials than I think, you know, those of us that grew up during the rise of the environmental movement.
There is a moment in the film when you say you started to see these things coming together, but then you hadn't considered the political element of it. And this gets us to a story that's playing out in Nevada, although I'm sure it's not just playing out there. But you focus on this question about solar rates and a story that played out there last year, and then things turned. But get us there, if you would, James Redford. Talk about the sort of the political argument that plays out here in Nevada.
Well, I think the interesting thing in Nevada is that when you think about that solar concentrated solar plant that I described earlier in this conversation, one of the investors is Nevada Energy, which is Nevada's energy monopoly. It's in the state constitution or whatever you'd describe it as, that this utility gets to operate without competition. And it's been that way for 100 years. So, you know, they're into centralized generation because they get to own it and control it and make money off of it and keep it to themselves, yeah. as they have done for 100 years.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily about the actual clean technology. It's about, can you still deliver profit to your shareholders? So when you see rooftop solar and other forms of solar coming in that are quote-unquote decentralized, meaning they don't control it, mm-hmm. it's a threat to their bottom line. And that trickles down to lobbyists, who trickle down to politicians. And in this case, you know, you've got three you had three unelected appointed officials of the Utilities Commission mm-hmm. that were just actively trying to discourage the spread of rooftop solar in Nevada. It's dispiriting, but at the same time, Nevada Energy, you know, if you look at what they're doing, the good news is they are making a lot of clean energy. And that's important. You can't ignore the role of the utilities. We're far better off trying to encourage them to switch over and make tons of clean energy than to just fight with them all the time. But Nevada was not a friendly landscape for this conversation. It was unfortunate.
I should mention here in Utah, last year, Rocky Mountain Power proposed this new rate structure for customers with solar panels. And they made this argument that comes up in your film that solar customers are being subsidized by their other customers. And solar advocates said that this proposal in Utah had a lot in common with the changes that were happening there in Nevada that really potentially could have decimated the solar industry. You know, here,
it's interesting. Rocky Mountain Power and Nevada Energy are owned by the same entity, which is Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah,
and Berkshire Hathaway is one of the leading investors in wind energy in America. So again, I'm sure that this old model of controlling the generation, controlling the distribution, handling the delivery to the consumer. That's what this is all about, maintaining that economic model. I think there's the sad thing is there's room for all of it. You can still make a lot of money and with letting people enjoy their own generation of electricity. We're never going to solve climate change with people's private homes and solar panels. So then there's room for that market. And so what you're seeing is a sort of fear-based, sort of greed-based reach to just, you know, dominate at all cost.
And, yeah.
My understanding is that the conversations have been somewhat more productive in Utah. I'm not sure.
Well, I should mention that Rocky Mountain they were able to come up with this compromise with solar businesses and state agencies and advocates. It basically grandfathers solar customers into this net metering program. The Public Service Commission is also conducting a study on the rate structure. So I'm not sure there's a conclusion to that part of the story yet. In Nevada, things swing. I mean, it looks discouraging for a bit, and then about a year later, you come back to it, and things look up, I guess, in that part of the story.
Well, yes, Nevada's got, you know, it's one of the many charms of Nevada is that its legislature meets every other year.
Yeah.
And for 4 months only. That's how they feel about government in Nevada.
Right.
So, you know, so when they came back around, they took a look at this, and they were also hearing a lot from their voters. And not only that, but you have to remember, Tesla built the world's largest man-made structure in the deserts of Nevada, outside of Reno. Its economic presence in the state is significant. So you're talking about other forces at play, other pressures at play there. And I believe that the result in Nevada, the turnaround in policy that allowed solar to continue to thrive, rooftop solar, as well as like 10 other clean energy bills, was a result of two things. The grassroots speaking to their representatives, but also the mighty force, the economic force of Tesla and other big companies. I mean, they're, as they become more profitable and more successful, of course, their lobbying power is going to increase as well.
There's a part of the story where you talk about your own experience with solar, that you had kind of toyed with the idea, but you had the same kinds of concerns that a lot of us have. Like, is it practical? Is it financially doable? But then you go all in, and in the process you have this home evaluation. And I wanted to ask you about this because it's, I guess I was struck by how it's this. It's really not. I mean, the making a major transition is important, but it's also a lot of this is about the simple stuff.
Yeah. So at the the Redford Center, we on our website redfordcenter.org, we have a long list of simple things for people to do. And that really stemmed from my own experience. I just took what I learned going through my house and decided, why not put this on our website, give everybody else a chance to see, you know, all these things really add up. And the interesting thing for me is that, you know, I looked into solar 10, 15 years ago, and it was that the panels weren't as effective, so I wasn't going to be getting the yield. It was going to take a lot longer to pay them off. Today, it takes anywhere from 4 to 8 years to pay off your solar system, and then you're on a free ride with electricity after that. And in states like New York, where electricity is expensive, it can be as little as 3 years, and then you've got free electricity. This has all changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, I looked at it, and I'm not a techie guy. I'm a Luddite. So I leased my panels. I regret that now.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want to deal with the hassle of. I just wanted to know I'd done it, and it didn't cost me anything extra from what I was paying for electricity already. So why not do it? But then once you do that, it's like, you know, when you buy a new piece of furniture for your home, and then suddenly something across the room looks bad.
Right, right.
And that's what started to happen in my house once I started to move towards it. Then the electric car seemed to make a lot of sense, because then I'd have a solar powered car, and then. You know, well, then my crappy bulbs, the first LED bulbs were kind of sucky, and I didn't like them. But then, you know, when I looked into it, they'd gotten a lot better, and they last for 25 years. They're probably going to outlive me. My light bulbs are going to live longer than me.
Right.
And so it's like, wow, amazing. So it's incremental, but it kind of catches on. I got to tell you, I was very late to this game.
That's James Redford. His film is called Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. We're going to be screening it next Thursday night as part of our Through the Lens series, our documentary partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. We get started at 7 o'clock. James will be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. James Redford, thanks very much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.